Hey listeners, Chloe here. If you need to stay as up to date with the latest developments and innovations in the luxury industry as I do, you need to dive into Vogue Business. It's your ticket to a global perspective on fashion and beauty, delivering exclusive insights that will give you the edge in this competitive, dynamic industry. Just visit VogueBusiness.com today and use the code RUN20 at checkout to join the Vogue Business community. That's VogueBusiness.com, promo code RUN20. Don't miss out. This is The Run Through. I'm Chloe Mao.
And I'm Cho Minardi.
And we are here to start by congratulating Miss Choma on another incredible Vogue cover. This month is Cara Delevingne. I don't know if I had so much fun reading this, but I enjoyed reading this.
Thank you.
I learned a lot about Cara. I feel like she opened up to you a lot. And that was just a muse bouche for us talking to her.
Yes.
But first, you are hot off your...
And back from Paris.
Your big sojourn.
Yes.
You went to many shows.
Yes. En route to Versace, might I add, tonight.
Oh my gosh, which is in L.A.
In L.A.
Ooh.
Yeah, I'm back in time for Oscars, don't worry.
Phew.
And here's a recap on the highlights of this Paris Fashion Week and this past crazy month of shows are Eugénie Trochu. She's a head of editorial content at Vogue France, which is basically the equivalent of an editor-in-chief, and Pierre Mappelli, who is the head of editorial content at GQ France. Hello, hello.
Hi, guys. So nice to meet you.
You guys haven't met?
No, we've never met.
You never met Chloe? She's the best.
Never. Hi, Chloe. Nice to meet you.
Hi.
Meet you.
So you've survived the week.
Yes. It's over.
Bravo.
You know what? I just finished the last show like 30 minutes ago.
So what were the best shows of the week? What was the highlight?
I would say Off-White.
Yeah.
Oh.
I thought it was just very aesthetically relevant, and I loved how Yves is really getting into his groove. So
our favorite, Yves Kamara,
yes,
who styled the Michaela Cole cover last year.
He's really talented. But I won't say it would be, you know, I think it's so difficult to say that there's one show that I like more than the other, because, you know, we were seeing like in between 5 to 8 shows every day.
Wow.
So I think to understand what is going to be like our favorite show, I think we need to wait a bit and to think and to see it again and maybe to analyze it a bit.
I love that Eugénie is saying this, because I was actually counting and there was 66 shows and 41 presentations. That's 107 brands on 9 days.
Oh my gosh.
This is crazy.
And how many of those
did
you go to?
Yeah, how many did you manage to get to?
Oh,
thank God. I'm only going to the ones that have men's wear. Very rarely I'm only doing women's wear. But I can't imagine what Eugénie has been doing, for instance.
Now, luckily, I'm not on my own. I have the whole team who's covering every show.
I kind of want to go back a little bit to get you guys to talk a little bit about how you fell in love with fashion and, you know, how you came to your positions now.
Well, and also we never
introduced
in.
You.
Will you guys introduce
yourselves?
Introduce yourselves. And tell us what you do.
Yeah.
So my name is Eugénie. I'm a French girl and I'm working for Vogue France since it's going to be now 12 years.
Oh, wow. Was it your first job? Because you're very young still.
Yeah, it was my first job.
Oh my gosh.
I joined Vogue as an intern.
So when did you first fall in? I know that you have a deep love of horses. You grew up, grew up riding horses, which I thought was really fascinating. But when was that moment when you fell in love with fashion?
To be honest, at the beginning, I liked fashion and I was really happy to do an internship at Vogue. But I was like, it was more a way of experimenting a new area. I wanted to be a journalist in just for horses, you know, also like to cover horse riding competition. And when I finished my internship with Fiona at Vogue US, I had the opportunity to go to this Vuitton show. And at this time it was with Marc Jacobs, and he was the one when Kate Moss closed the show when she was smoking. You remember the one with the elevators?
Yes. Iconic.
Iconic.
Iconic. You know, and me, I had the chance I had like Phyllis Posnick place because she was not coming to Paris, and so she gave me her invitation, and I was like, oh my god, this is what I wanted.
Legendary Vogue editor Phyllis Posnick.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah,
you had a good seat.
So I had such a good seat, and no one was like, "Oh my god, this is what I want to do. I want to see that." It's wow. Like for me, it was art.
No, it was like literally like lightning struck you. So there was an actual moment that you.
Yeah.
coup de foudre? What is it?
Coup de foudre. Yeah.
Coup de foudre. Yes. Yes. Totally. And you know, it happens to me again, like sometimes when I see a show, it really struggled me like that. And I have the same feeling.
Mm. What was the last show that did that to you?
The last show gave that to me. It was Ferragamo in Milan.
Huh.
I honestly think that Milan crushed Paris, and it.
A lot of people are saying that's word on the street.
Interesting.
Milan crushed Paris. You never hear that.
Yeah.
And you guys are Team Paris, so that's a big concession to make.
Yes, it's a big concession.
Exactly, like it hurts. It hurts
true.
To say
it's
it.
True.
I won't disagree with you.
Bottega and Ferragamo were definitely my top shows of the season. I think we went back to something more sort of civilized and, you know, dressed up and paying attention to the cuts and the shapes and how they fit the body, you know, whichever, you know, body. So I'm quite surprised that Milan has been to me the best season.
And Pierre, what about you?
When was that moment when you fell in love with fashion?
I fell in love with fashion. I was, I think, like a young teen, and I had just moved to Nigeria from Morocco because of my parents' jobs, and I was looking for cartoons on TV.
Did you grow up in Morocco?
Yeah, I grew up born in Paris, grew up in France, then Ivory Coast, Morocco, Nigeria, wow. Benin, a bit of Togo. Then I moved to London to study. But then in Nigeria, I was just looking for cartoons on TV, and I stumbled across fashion TV, and I was like, what the hell is that? There was a Karl Lagerfeld Chanel show, Fall 89, the couture. I think Kimo Ali Simmons was closing the show, replacing Inez. It was, and I was just like, what is this? I was always aware of fashion and but not as an industry. Like, I loved clothing. I'm originally from Congo, Brazzaville. So, you know, women and men love
sapeurs. Isn't that where the sapeurs are from?
Exactly. So then I was like, what is this? And I just started researching. And as I, the more I researched, the worse my math grades were getting.
Oh, no.
And I was in my math classes. But then, yeah. To me, that was a moment. I felt like it was, you know, it was a real revelation, I'd say.
And now you're editing GQ in France.
Yeah.
So exciting.
It's been, you know, there's so many conversations to have with men and show them all the possibilities, all the things that they can be. And we always talk about new masculinities. And that's something that I wanted to push at GQ.
Wait, back to Fashion Week. I'm going to go out and say that, obviously, I think everybody was watching Balenciaga the most. It was a very pivotal season for that brand.
And did it live up to anticipation?
Yeah, I want to know what it was like to be there.
So it was really simple. It was a white box. And it was really like a ceremony in a way. I don't know if it's the right word, but I think it was really, really, you know, back to this a sense of fashion shows.
I loved, he left this, a lot of people on Instagram were sharing the show notes, the kind of personal
statement
that he left, and he on all of the seats, and he talked about having, going back to this memory of when he first fell in love with fashion, right? And having this suit made for himself as a child and going back every day to kind of revise it. What did you make of that, Pierre?
I thought it was, you know, a good sort of a message to send out there to, you know, current designers, young designers, fashion students. You know, we shouldn't forget that this industry is based off skills and based on being able to make clothes that will move you. But, you know, the making of clothes is super important. And I had the chance to go backstage and ask him a question, because obviously, we know what happened, you know, with the brand and himself over the past couple of months. And I asked him, you know, what at which point in the process did you have the most fun? And he said, well, when I was making the evening dresses, and that his team was sort of saying, what the F, you know, why are we doing this? And they were just having fun making those things that felt like couture, even though they weren't made in a couture way, because all of this will be industrialized. So I'm happy that he manages to have fun.
Wait, off topic. You know, here we still have this craze around French girl style.
It's true.
What do you guys actually think of our fetishize, like the way that we fetishize Parisian culture? You know, I think you've done such a good job, Eugenie, of changing the idea of what Parisian style, French style looks like and made it more inclusive.
Yes, because I think it's like it's a myth in a way, you know, when you go to the even like the countryside, or you can't see these girls that everyone is thinking, like, you know, when you see that. This like Godard or
yeah, it's still that like, it's always new wave cinema. It's
yes,
like
in fact, of course, it's so inspiring, and I'm loving these girls, Brigitte Bardot, and they are like so gorgeous. But I think we change a bit the way of representing this French girl now.
Who do you love? But, like, who are your sort of muses, star muses? Like, who should I go check out?
You know this girl called Luce and the Yakuza? She was at
the Vision. Yes, love her. She's, oh.
Eugenie, can you spell it for the audience?
Louse.
And you must check her out. She's got the best style.
You put her on the cover, right?
Yeah, she was. Yeah.
Good call. I think she's so fabulous.
I think for me, she can embody the new French girl.
So tell us, Eugenie, what is going to be in your wardrobe next season? What are you shopping from these collections? What is it? Are you getting a good blazer, a good boot? Like, what are you feeling for?
I think about blazer. Blazer was like the ultimate piece of this season. But I think if you want a blazer, you go to Saint Laurent, because the comeback of the jacket was like I think it was the major thing in this show, and I like the fact he did again, like, you know, this power jacket with like the huge shoulders, and I think we're gonna see that everywhere next season. Mm-hmm. What else? What I like really well a lot, it was Miu Miu. Because for me, it's
the
like
granny panties. No,
no, the panties. But I think it's more about like the jacket, and she's representing something that we can see everywhere. You know, it's like the mom on run. You know, like she doesn't have time to brush her hair.
She loved it.
Jacket with like you know, it's like more.
The hair was genius.
Jogging bottoms. It's like it's easy. Even the pumps, we saw that at Miu Miu and Prada, you know, kitten heels.
So you're getting you're investing in a kitten heel. You're investing in a blazer. Yes. Is there a bag you have your eye on, or a big?
The Gucci one. You know that.
What did they look like?
It's, you know, it's like the bags like you saw when you was Tom Ford with the horse riding stuff. You know, man.
Right, with the horse bit.
Yes.
Well, you would like that, wouldn't you? As a former
equestrian.
Pierre, was there anything that you're kind of feeling for?
I know what Pierre is going to say. He's going to say Balmain.
Yes. You know what? I just want a little bit of fantasy. I was, you know, in cars walking around Paris, and I was like, come on, everyone could make a little bit more effort. And to me, the ultimate effort is Balmain.
It's,
you know,
true.
It's like for 15 minutes at the women's show, and, you know, I was forgetting about, you know, the war in Ukraine. I was forgetting about whatever, you know, is going on with the economy. And I was like, wow, for 15 minutes, I can just enjoy this fantasy. And I really think that if we behave and think that way, you know, it would make us feel, you know, a bit better when you wake up in the morning and you put on a glamorous outfit, even if it's just to go to the bakery to get a baguette, you know. Yeah. You can do that.
Well, on that lovely note.
On that lovely note, yes, on Vive la Glamour.
And Vive la Mode.
Vive la Mode.
Thank you. It was fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us. Bye-bye.
This is The Run Through with Vogue. We'll be back in just a minute.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu.
host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi everyone, it's Chloe, and I'm so excited to share something fabulous with you, Vogue's first ever global fashion community, Vogue Club. Our members get to mingle with Vogue editors, yes, including me, and fellow fashion enthusiasts at exclusive events around the world. And that's just the start. Membership opens doors to the fashion industry, bringing you expert career advice and insider style and beauty tips. What are you waiting for? Head over to vogue.com/membership to join, and here's a little treat. Use code TRT20 and snag 20% off your membership. That's TRT20 for 20% off your ticket to Vogue Club. Are you in?
So the new issue of Vogue came out this week. I wrote the cover story. It's with Cara Delevingne, shot by Annie Leibovitz. I mean, if you don't know who Cara Delevingne is, she is...
I do, for the record. Carry on.
For those who don't, she's a British actress and model, and she's been modeling for a while.
I mean, I can't believe she's only 30. I feel like she has been around for ages, but I guess she started in what, 2009?
She started in 2009. I mean, modeling has become something that's more of a side hustle now, and acting is her main thing. But she really became
She
huge.
Really made a sensation on the runways and ad campaigns. Her caterpillar brows.
I remember writing a story, actually.
About her eyebrows?
I had my eyebrows because I overplucked them when I was younger. So I just seeing her, I wrote a story about how I wanted eyebrows like her. And so
oh my gosh, did you tell her this when you interviewed her?
I didn't. I know.
Cara, if you're listening, this is an important tidbit.
Beyond her obvious beauty and good looks, she has such a great sense of humor. And I think that's what struck a chord with people. And she was just really good at Instagram when Instagram was new. And she's very candid. She's a natural kind of comedian.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, after she had this huge moment in fashion, she sort of transitioned into acting.
What were her big movies?
It started with Anna Karenina. She was in Paper Towns. More recently, she was in Suicide Squad. And I think what really kind of captured my attention for this story was watching Planet Sex, which is a documentary series that she made with Hulu that just explains and go and kind of digs deeper and explores this idea of female desire and sexuality, and she unpacks, you know, her own queer identity within it.
Mm.
And I think it was a really pivotal experience for her. You know, it was a turning point for her, you know, approaching her 30th birthday, thinking about what her kind of adulthood and more mature adulthood would look like, and also kind of struggling with addiction, everything kind of came to a head around her birthday.
And so you were sort of marshaled in to get this very sensitive, untold story from her. We recorded the day you were leaving and you were nervous.
I was nervous. I've never done an interview as sensitive as this.
Yeah.
I mean, usually I'm called in for the fashion stories. So I went in very nervous. She's really warm. I think she kind of helped me better understand the language of sobriety, and she's just really smart and emotionally intelligent and deep, you know. So it took a while, obviously, to gain trust, because I can't imagine what it must have been like, but she did over the course of a couple of conversations. So I feel really proud of it. And
I'm really proud of you.
Yeah,
and I'm I was really excited to speak to her with you. And we had such a great conversation. She was so frank and present. Mm. And you can see she just has this sort of devilish wit, even talking about something as weighted as this. So it makes it sort of a joy to have an interaction like that with someone. And you got to meet her dogs, who I love. You can hear them in the background. Yes. It's like they're part of the interview.
Yeah, they're very sweet. Hey, Cara.
Hi, Cara.
What's up, guys? Hi.
Congrats on your cover.
Dude, it's amazing.
It's I'm really so great. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Again, it's a very incredible moment. I was reading it yesterday and I cried. It was very sweet. The bit about my granny still gets me. It's weird. That really means I'm still processing it, because I obviously wasn't for so long, because every time I talk about it or when I hear about it, it makes me cry. But it's amazing. It's vulnerable and raw and, you know, totally honest. But your sensitivity to the whole situation is very sweet, because it's a hard thing to talk about.
You know what? I was just telling Chloe earlier that I learned so much doing this with you, and I think you helped guide me, because honestly, like, having the language to talk about healing, to talk about everything around this, to talk about sobriety, everything, I think, you know, I went in quite anxious. I remember first meeting you at your home, and it was I felt, you know, I'm a fashion girl, I don't know, I didn't really know what to expect, I didn't know the language around it, and you really sort of, like, it was a bit of a collaboration. You taught me some things. No, I mean, don't you think that the language around how we talk about this is so important?
Yeah, and that's why I think I had to kind of make my own. Obviously, people talk about healing, but I think one of the biggest problems I have is being hard on myself. And in terms of the word recovery, it didn't work for me. Like, healing is something that I've always been directed towards internally, and may not have done it, but that's always what I've been trying to do, but not succeeded, and not really given myself the opportunity to do it fully.
What are some examples of ways people tend to talk about sobriety and addiction that you found more challenging and that you've tried to sort of rename for yourself and for your own journey on this?
I think even addiction in itself has so much negative connotations to it, which obviously it's not a great thing, but I think there's so many words that are just used around it, whether you're, like, you know, a druggie, or like a loser, or, you know, you're a fuck up. It's just a lot of those things where, how the hell is that meant to help someone who's trying to heal or who's in pain? And I think in itself, what I've discovered about this is, it's, for me, it's a superpower in a way. I think whether people suffer from addiction or not, it's again a deeper problem of people who have an issue with coping and an issue with soothing themselves, how people cope with things, how, you know, people are meant to take drugs or drink alcohol to enhance, not cover up. And I think that is a problem of masses, that people, it's a coping strategy. I want people to be able to relate to this in any way they can, or take something from it, because this, the last thing I wanted from this story was to go, oh, look, poor me, please feel sympathy for me, because that's not what I want at all. I'm a strong person. There's so much I have going for me, and now, especially moving forward, I didn't want to be like, oh, pity me, but I wanted to be able to say my piece and also explain that there is a way out. There's a way to change your story, or a way to change your narrative or situation. And the whole kind of victim mentality of, like, I can't, or, you know, putting things on yourself. It's like, yeah, things have happened, but it's not, I'm not trying to make it about that, I suppose. Because again, I had a part in all of it. It's not like it happened.
I don't know. I mean, when you were talking to me, it was one of the first people outside of people you know that you were saying it out loud. Was there some apprehension in that, is there any apprehension now that you're telling your story and the world is hearing it, or does that feel?
Apprehension, no. I think at this point, I'm wearing this as armor in a good way, if that makes sense. But I'm ready for people to see it. And it's not something I'm hiding, and I'd like that, because I think that's something that kept me sick, was hiding things.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so
the biggest way of not hiding anything.
But I'm just going to appreciate also the beauty of the cover, because I thought it was, and it felt like you know, it was just very
raw.
Yeah, raw and just...
I've never done a cover like that. You know, they chose to have like very, like no makeup basically. And I'm very used to me having photos taken of me, which are very manicured.
Where was the cover shot?
It was shot like outside Malibu.
Okay.
In like, it felt like we were in like the Highlands. It was okay. So green.
It looked like the Highlands. I was like, wait, is this Scotland or Ireland?
Yeah, I was so confused. I was like, what? Because I always sleep in cars, especially if I'm driving in a long to a further destination. And I woke up, I was like, sorry, wait, where are we? It was fun. It was a great day. I mean, the first shot we did, it was so emotional. I cried so much. I was like, I think for my team as well, oh my God, I can't tell you just how much it means. Because honestly, like, I think deep down it's something I always wanted, was to be in this situation, not doing a cover of Vogue. Obviously that is amazing, but to be sober and to do that on top of is something I really didn't think was possible, but I wanted it so badly inside. I just didn't know how to get there.
Yeah, honestly. I'm sure you see everything must feel and be different. It's just moving in the world in a different way now.
Yeah, completely. And that's the thing I've discovered, is I can do anything. Like, there aren't any limitations. I just came back from Vegas. I had the best time ever. Like, there is nothing I can't do.
Oh, wow. That's a big deal.
Yeah, but that's the thing. It's like, if I'm sound of mind and whatever, I'm like, you know, I can kind of take on anything. And it's so, that's the biggest kind of show, where every day I just get so much more confidence up. I'm like, you know, strong enough to do anything. That's cool.
It's cool when you can actually hear your kind of body talking to you. You know what I mean? Like, when you can act on your instinct and your gut.
Yeah, I couldn't trust myself before. And now I'm like fully, I'm all one. Because I think before I had so much internal conflict going on, wanting to change, but not.
It was quite emotional for me talking to you about your childhood, you know, and obviously you were very candid about the first experience. And this was a moment where you had to educate me, because I said, I think I said alcohol abuse, and it's misuse. You corrected me. It's misuse, right? We were talking about the first time that you had.
Yeah, because abuse, it's like I didn't know I was abusing it.
Yeah.
I mean, like consciously.
You didn't. I mean, you couldn't. You were like 7 years. I can't imagine. You were 7 years old.
Yeah, I guess as well, being the youngest in a family, it's tricky when I'm 6 years younger than my sister Poppy. And I always felt like not an only child, but I would always be like, why can't I be up? Why can't I be treated like everyone else in this situation? And why did they get to do things I don't? To be fair, how old were they? They were 13 and 15. So they weren't that much older than me, but I just felt like I wanted to be an adult. But again, even at that age, I was going through very adult things.
You know, I was impressed by the way you were able to, that you've been able to process some of the things that, some of the experiences that you were having as a teenager, as a child, you know. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about some of those experiences?
I just grew up very fast, very young. And I think the most important part about that is that I just didn't think it was abnormal, and I didn't feel like I had the right to feel, because again, I think I saw so much of, especially my mother, struggling, and I didn't want to cause any more pain. So I didn't want to show anything was affecting me. And that's the typical thing that happens. And I just became addicted to people pleasing. I mean, addicted to just like, I mean, addicted is the wrong word, but avid people pleaser, because I could handle it. And if I just, that's how I learned, is to hold everything in, to bottle everything up. And it came out in really bad ways, and it does always. Because I didn't understand that jumping off high things and being completely reckless with my body in multiple different ways was just me wanting to feel and feel pain. But like, you know, I didn't give a shit about my life in the sense that not my life. I didn't give a shit about my own body. Mm. I didn't understand what emotional pain was. So I was like, okay, physical pain, if that can match what I feel inside, that makes sense. And that's it's a dangerous space to be into, because I think you take that on and you get older. And I think I've just replaced that hurting myself with drugs, because it's the same thing, and alcohol.
Yeah, I mean, I talked to Sienna Miller, who is a good friend of yours, for the story. And it was really interesting to hear her perspective, because obviously she remembered when she first met you. And she said she was in awe of just how natural you were with social media. I mean, at that point, you were a rocket into space, the way that you instantly had a gazillion followers almost overnight. What was that like for you? You know, I know you had a difficult childhood. I can't imagine what it must have been like to be suddenly thrust into the spotlight.
I was lucky in every way. When you have so much externally, you know, holidays and toys and things that, like, I was very lucky, an amazing education. It's when you don't get the simple things, the nourishment, the kind of like emotional care. I mean, I suppose there were just little things that, again, that's why I always felt so guilty about the fact that I was feeling so depressed, because I had everything, but that wasn't everything to me. That's why I think going into modeling and wanting people to love me was so hard, because I was like, this is the thing that I need, but it wasn't in the right way. And, you know, when people say, oh, you were good at social media, I was like, I was just being myself. And now it's harder slightly, only because I like to keep a part of myself. I don't want to talk about where I am every day, what I'm doing, because fame does not allow for that. I was able to be very connected to my fans and talk to a lot of people who were going through similar things, especially when I became vocal about being queer and having depression and anxiety or whatever through stages of my life. I was very much able to like feel like I could support people, but that again wasn't sustainable. I want to help inspire, but if I get too attached as well to like people's situations, it's not good, because all I want to do is save people. So it's not helpful sometimes. But I appreciate my fans so much. But it's confusing, because a lot of the times when I, you know, it was happening, people don't care about you as a person. They just care about you as a commodity. So it's like, it doesn't feel good at the end of the day. You know, because I remember like crying my eyes out and someone coming up to me like, can I take a photo? I was like, no, not right now, please. But like a lot of the time, again, I would always say yes to people no matter what situation I was in. And that really had to learn how to say no. But it, again, all of those things took me so long, because I didn't want to let anyone down. I didn't want to disappoint anyone. And I think that was also part of a situation where I think hiding a lot of what I was going through also was another thing of not wanting to disappoint people, not wanting people to let people in or know that I was struggling. Because again, I have such an incredible life and I have all these things that other people want, and I didn't want them to know I was fucking it up, I suppose, but I wasn't, but you know.
Well, and it also goes, I mean, you say you were hiding it, but also because of your fame, you weren't able to hide some of it. Mm. I mean, you unfortunately had to have paparazzi photos of you at a very sick moment come out. Was there any part of that that was helpful in making you realize I'm at a moment where I need to shift, or was that just always felt like an invasion of your space?
But I mean, being famous is constantly, and you have to be prepared for that. And they don't give you a handbook of what you need to be prepared for, but that is what it comes with. I think people think a lot of things about fame, and it's just not what it's cracked up to be. But that's also part of being in this industry, is you sell this idea of, you glamorize a life. And so it is kind of people in my position's fault, including me. Those paparazzi photos, there have been so many, that's the thing. And I think a lot of people knew, not that I was necessarily struggling, but like, she's fucked up, she's having a good time, or I don't know. Because I guess when you're in your 20s, it isn't as like, serious, or I mean there are so many moments that I've had that, but I think there was something very different about those photos, because I wasn't there anymore, I was gone, there was no sign of me inside that photo. What it see for me, I look at that and I'm like, wow, I I don't recognize myself at all in there.
And for people who are listening who may not have seen the photos, it was pictures of you returning from Burning Man, right?
Yeah.
You know, I'm so interested in how I think people are so afraid of having a conversation with a loved one about a struggle that they're having. What was sort of the playbook for your friends when they sat you down, and what really resonated with you of, yes, I do need to listen to this? Was it about your trust in them, or was there something they said specifically that was really helpful?
I think just that people were worried, and I hate worrying people. And it's also a scary thing when someone's so scared for your health and safety and well-being, but you don't care. That's when it's scary. I think the problem is, in a lot of these situations, is people don't want to help themselves. And that's the hardest thing. There's nothing you can do. There's a lot about this disease that it's, you're helpless. Unless someone wants to change, there is, you're, a lot of the time, you're only going to push them away if you try and force anyone to do anything.
You turned 30 too. I mean, it was also, because I know you talked about in your 20s, right? So yeah. this is a big year for you as far as like resetting everything.
It really is. It's a new chapter. And it wasn't even my 20s, because, like, you know, it started when I was like 14.
Wow.
Even in that period of my life, I learned a lot. But again, I don't regret any of it, but I'm so glad I'm not there anymore.
And it's been a few months now that you're sober.
Yeah, since last year, the end of last year.
And I have had so much fun the past week watching Planet Sex as I got ready for this. I feel like I learned so much, and I learned more about you than about anything else. Was that, you know, I read in Choma's piece what you said, but it sounded like you really went there and it was a very raw experience for you. What did it take to get you to really open up for that?
Not a lot. I think I was ready for it, but okay. I just didn't understand. Again, I try and live in the present, and always in that situation, I was like, you know, whatever happens, happens. And I think there was so much left of myself that I hadn't uncovered. So there were so many people's experiences. I met so many incredible people that I helped me identify and see parts of myself in.
Cara, will you just explain to anyone who hasn't watched Planet Sex what the elevator pitch of what the show is?
Yeah, it's a documentary about sexuality, identity, gender, relationships, all around the world, across culture, religion. And it's an exploration of the world in that sense, but also it becomes a huge discovery of my own journey throughout queer womanhood.
Do you feel like it helped you evolve your understanding of your sexuality? Like, I love when you say that you're a shit gay person. Do you feel like you're less of that now?
No, I think I'll always be. I'm not going to compare myself to other people who are queer, but I think it definitely evolved it. I think it really evolved more so like what I want in terms of love and relationships and stuff. But again, that Planet Sex world is very open and the rest of the world is not. So right. It didn't really look into like the people and the situations where it's like people are just close-minded.
I was just thinking about how I would have loved to have watched it when I was younger, because I think you gave women, you know, there isn't that much permission giving to women to feel desire, to explore their sexuality. And actually our producer was saying, well, what do you think Cara would have want to have said to her younger self about this? Like, what are the tips? Because I was like, I've obviously, you know, much older now, much wiser now, we hope. But there was so much in there that I was like, oh, I wish I'd known that. And some of it was new to me too, about my own body, you know?
Mm. And I think as well, like when I was younger, I would have loved to have known, like, no is a full sentence.
Yes.
No is a full sentence. To explore, but also when you're that young, when you're a teenager, when you're in your 20s, you are uncomfortable a lot of the time. But when someone else makes you feel uncomfortable, you don't have to please anyone else. Mm. Like, I think it's important to explore, but to be safe. Mm. And I think the pressure, you know, I lost my virginity late in comparison to people, but I still felt like I was young. I was 18. Mm. But mentally, emotionally, you know, and I think there's so much pressure to adhere to culture's sexuality in the sense that, like, you know, it's something that it's a rite of passage. It's not. It's like you can work by your own clock and your own life, and you should not succumb to anyone else's ideas of what you should be doing. And again, blue balls is not a thing. Not a thing. Doesn't exist. Go to the bathroom, sort yourself out, love. Is that an issue? It doesn't happen, let's be honest. Like, come on. It's something that was designed to make women feel bad about the fact that, no, it's ridiculous.
Take us to some of the, I mean, the spaces that you were in. I think the first, I thought, oh God, I've forgotten the name of the festival.
The Dinosaur Weekend?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was, seemed cool.
It was. It really was. It was beautiful. I mean, the first thing I did was see, like, women naked spanking each other. Not that that's the whole festival. I was like, oh, wow, this is, like, not a joke. It made me feel all the things, happiness, joy, like appreciation, but also I kind of felt uncomfortable. And that was weird for me because I was like, I felt uncomfortable because I was like, oh, I don't have to be straight seeming. I guess this is a place where I can really feel queer.
Cara, will you just tell people what the Dinosaur Weekend is?
So it's the biggest congregation. It's a dinosaur pool party in Palm Springs. It's the biggest congregation of lesbian and non-binary. It's a pool party.
Will there be a season two of Planet Sex?
Yeah, we need a season two.
We'll see.
Yeah, what are you feeling like creatively now? I mean, having this must have rearranged how you think about what you want as a, you know, creative person, like where you want to go. And you don't have to reveal everything.
No,
but
yeah,
like,
yeah.
What mood are you in now?
I mean, again, I don't want to work just to work. I want to feel about a project like, if I don't do this, I will explode. Like, it has to be something I really care about. But I'm still discovering a lot. You know, there was a lot of pressure I was putting on myself to finish projects that I started myself. Because I was like, look, I'm sober, I can now finish stuff. But, like, it just happens when it happens. I do have a problem with discipline in that sense, though, that I'm like, I think I got a big fear of writing. Because
honey,
I used to
me
write.
Me too. It is horrible. It's like scraping the bottom of your soul.
Yeah.
We're just really excited and happy that you're on this new path. So
thank you so much, Cara. Bye.
Thank you, Chloe. Bye, Juma.
Well, I can't wait to see season two of Planet Sex.
Me
and
too.
Whatever next step Cara, Team Cara is up to.
Yeah, definitely rooting for her.
Mm-hmm. And we are excited because not only is Choma going to Los Angeles for 48 hours for the Versace show, but the Oscars are this Sunday. And you know who's here for you? We are.
Woo-hoo!
The run through. We are putting out a special episode next Monday morning, recapping all of the best Oscar fashion with some of our dear friends and colleagues here at Vogue. Be sure to check your feed Monday morning for that special Easter egg.
The Run Through is a production of Condé Nast. I'm Choma Nardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel. Bye.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.